Today's episode is brought to you in part by InterOptic. You know how your Switch vendor's optics are unbelievably expensive? With InterOptic, you've got a budget-conscious option with no compromises, OEM quality optics at a fraction of the price. Check them out at interoptic.com and listen to weekly show 360 to find out more. Today's episode is brought to you in part by Cumulus Networks. Cumulus has made enormous contributions to the open source community, code that's used all over the industry. Read Cumulus's open source philosophy at cumulusnetworks.com/openpod. cumulusnetworks.com/openpod.
Welcome to the Packet Pushers Weekly Podcast, a show about networking and its place in enterprise IT infrastructure. Now, a few weeks back, Bloomberg, the well-known press, published an article making unsubstantiated claims about a supply chain breach around x86 servers. These uncorroborated claims led to a firestorm of debate in security circles that range from "I told you so" to "it's impractical" to "it was only a matter of time." Today, the Bloomberg article is widely regarded as a basic falsehood full of lies, and everyone involved, including sources, advisors, and vendors, issuing comprehensive denials that any of this actually happened. Well, okay. The hardware supply chain wasn't compromised, but can we stop it if we had to? No matter what you say, technology is a global business with hundreds of suppliers doing design, making the chips, making DRAMs, making components that get assembled into subcomponents, which then get shipped to China to be assembled. That's not going to change. So my initial reaction was, is there a technology solution? Now, many people will know about the Apple T2 chipset that adds a whole bunch of security features to an iPhone. What a lot of people don't know is that that chip actually means if you put third-party non-approved components in it, the phone will brick. That's a supply chain integrity issue. Actually, it's a repair integrity issue for Apple. So I started looking at how we secure the supply chain in enterprise IT and started diving into things called hardware secure enclaves, such as Intel's trusted execution or software guard extensions or the ARM crypto island features or the other one that comes from AMD. And when I raised these issues on the Network Break 205, I got a strong response from a number of vendor salary slaves pointing me to various documentation about these security features being implemented in their products. And then so on 206, I actually published a bit of a retraction and said, oh no, the vendors have got this under control. And then I was contacted by my guest today who have had a number of years of actually working on these technologies who sort of went, not quite so right, Greg. So so I thought what we would do is rather than me try and regurgitate this is to welcome them to the show. So Greg, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, sure. My name is Greg Shipley. I lead the Cyber Reboot Lab, which is a InQtel applied research lab, and I'll let my colleague Justin Wilder introduce himself.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having us. This is Justin Wilder. I'm a vice president at InQtel, and I run our cyber practice and largely doing investments in the cyber landscape.
Now, the thing that both of you seem to have done in the past is you tell me that you've been working extensively in this hardware integrity, supply chain security, supply chain integrity issue for some time, and you've actually worked on these technologies.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I'll kick it off and Justin can kind of give some updates on what he's seen in the startup and market side. But I first got exposed to the technology in relation to an investment we did in a company called HITRUST a number of years ago.
Yeah.
And HITRUST, at the time, we were interested in HITRUST because they added some role-based access control mechanisms to VMware ecosystems that were notably absent. But they also were working on developing TXT, trusted boot technology for VMware implementations, for ESX specifically. Mm-hmm. And so we started going down the path of actually implementing an internal within our organization. And this kind of opened the door to, oh, well, this is a little bit more complicated than just saying I want to turn it on, right?
Yeah.
And so we learned, and we can go into more detail, but we learned a bunch of things like, you know, so HP and Dell say that they offer this, but it turns out they don't offer it in all of their server lines. It's only a specific subset of server lines, and how they implement it is differently. Like some of the vendors ship a daughter card and some actually have it on specifically on a motherboard. And then you have the issue of the TXT functionality in the Intel feature set's got to line up with the BIOS, which has to line up with the TPM version. And then to say nothing about the operational procedures that you have to be aware of when you implement this stuff. So when I heard the podcast, I was like, yeah, that's true. TXT is out there, but it's not
actually being used.
Ubiquitous.
It's not ubiquitous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I was just going to add, I started first looking at this as our customers were beginning to move towards cloud adoption. Hmm. And in particular, the issue that we were facing was, in those cloud-enabled environments, how do we begin to extend the root of trust outside of or beyond hardware up through the hypervisor into the guest operating system? So even in the context of HITRUST, while we can use TXT to assert that the base hardware, the platform itself, and the host operating system has reached a known good state, once we start loading guests inside of that hosted environment, all bets are off. And certainly once we consider those base or those guest operating systems during their lifetime, during their runtime, there's no assertion of trust or security at that point either from TXT.
Okay, so I guess what we first need to explain to people is, what is root of trust? What do you mean by root of trust?
So root of trust is basically a premise that's implemented via TPM, a trusted platform module that stores a series of assertions or measurements of the boot process and the underlying operating system that TXT ultimately relies on to provide that kind of supply chain from cold boot to even warm boot, all the way up and through when either the hypervisor loads, if it's a type one hypervisor, or all the way through the base operating system. So it's a way to measure at various check-in points from the point of the power button being pressed all the way through to a nominal running state of the base operating system.
So Justin, is it fair to say, characterize it then as you're basically checking to make sure the operating system that loads, the kernel that loads, is the kernel you expect to load, as opposed to a modified one? Is that
exactly? Yeah. So I mean, the general concept is to really enable isolation and tamper detection throughout the boot process. Right. The objective really is to validate that no unauthorized changes have been made to the platform or the base operating system.
But not when you say to the platform, you mean to the hardware as well as the software, right?
Yeah. So hardware and firmware. So TXT relies on this TPM to provide that secure measurement component. Yeah. So TPM stores the measurement. TXT just has various check-in points, querying the TPM. Does this particular hash match this stage of my boot process?
Yeah.
And it provides that local attestation, remote attestation, to ensure that again that device reaches a known good state. Conclusion.
Yeah. So this is how I understand it. So correct me where I'm wrong. Is an x86 server or any device has an FPGA chip on it, which is the boot chip. It's usually called when the power supply comes up and reaches stable voltage. The first thing that actually comes up is this FPGA, and it's a little tiny chip with an onboard programming environment, which then monitors all of the memory buses and the CPUs. And then when the power comes stable, it checks that all of the modules that are there are actually coming online. They're powered up into a known start state. And then it says to the CPU, okay, now you can start the boot cycle. And that's one of the key chips, because if you can compromise the FPGA, you can actually tell the CPU to boot, to go off to some memory location and load some code, or you can tell the ROM to load some code that happens before the OS loads. So there's this hardware boot root of trust that has to happen before you actually get to the kernel boot.
Yeah, that's right. So in its implementations may vary, but the TPM, I assume that's what you're referring to when you say FPGA, is effectively that. It is providing that anchor, that point that once it's been, let's say, burned with the appropriate hashes for each of the stage of the boot process, and there's these program registers that capture and store these particular check-in points that are queried at each stage to validate that the hashes match. And if they don't match, the idea is that either the device gets bricked it at least has some sort of notification that it's not in a known state. It's particularly important when you consider like patches and modifications to even to the BIOS, let alone even to the base operating.
So the TPM, as I understand it, sort of says it's burned at the factory when it's actually manufactured. So it's not burned in the assembly manufactory. It's actually burned at the silicon maker with a program inside. And part of that includes a crypto functionality as well as some internal storage. And it's actually looking to monitor things like, are the chip signatures. So when I get manufactured in the factory, the TPM actually keys to the CPU to say, this is the CPU that I'm associated with. And there's a cryptographic exchange there and things like that.
There is a cryptographic exchange between the CPU and TPM, but the one thing that you would note is that the TPM is not burned in the sense that It's locked into a particular operating system. Now, the OEM may do that. They may configure that and effectively, you know, lock in their base OS, but it's on the system owner to continuously update the program registers as they make updates and modifications to whether it be the system BIOS, if they've got access to do that, or patches to the base operating system.
And I think, if I can add to that, I think there's a point here worth making, which is when you watch parts of our broader ecosystem like Intel bring these security features to market, they often, you know, spec the feature, they build it in, they ship it, they put some proof of concept out there, and then they expect the downstream kind of suppliers to pick this up and run with it. So in the case of Intel TXT, I mean, this is not new tech. This has been around for years, but how it actually gets implemented is a different process, and it varies per vendor, right? How HP implements it and how Dell implements it might be slightly different, and how, I don't know, Lenovo or someone else comes along might be radically different. And it's hard for the consumer at the end of all of this to go, oh, you know, vendor X implemented this thing really thoroughly, and vendor Y, it looks like they really cut some corners. It's far from transparent. Like, it's hugely opaque. And that was one of the challenges we ran into as well.
Yeah. So we have to secure the supply chain. So Intel developed trusted execution technology, which is this, is like as I understand it, is like an umbrella term for a bunch of technologies, which is partly hardware, which is the trusted platform module, the TPM, and partly software APIs to talk to the TPM. And also partly the third part is that operating systems and server vendors also have to implement various functions themselves to activate the trusted execution technology as such.
That's correct. Yeah. And particularly when we start thinking about how do we remotely attest the running state of a particular device, I think this becomes particularly interesting when we start thinking about networking technologies where inherently they are by definition wired and able to be reached remotely, is now I can potentially use TXT and the TPM root of trust as a way to remotely validate that host operating system has come up in a known good state, has not been tampered with. Now, the thing to highlight here is that this is software, looking at firmware and the base operating system. This is not necessarily something that would, despite the belief around the Bloomberg article, you know, if something actually were implemented where there was an actual attack on BMC controller, as was speculated in that article, TXT would not prevent that from happening, not give you that assertion. The presumption is that particular piece of hardware is something that's accessed after the system's been booted.
And relatively independent.
Relatively independent. It is not part of the boot process, and therefore it is not interrogated.
So we should probably explain what a BMC baseband motherboard controller is.
I certainly cannot explain that.
Greg, you should do that.
Go for it.
Good job. Yeah, you did a good job.
It's a remote management system. Yeah, go for it.
The BMC is fundamentally a computer inside of a computer. So and it's the sole point of value add that fundamentally any server maker or any computer maker can add to the common chips that Intel makes. So Intel makes the CPUs and the memory drivers and the bus controllers and all the Ethernet and the graphics chips that goes in most computers today, right? So if you're somebody like a Cisco or a HP or a Lenovo or a Supermicro, the one place that you can add value is bending metal and putting airflow across them and choosing which components to have. And the other one is, how do you do out-of-band administration of these servers? And that's the BMC. So Dell has its DRAC, HP has its ILO. They've all got different names for them, and they're branded. And these companies design their own controllers, and they're sort of generically called BMC, baseboard motherboard controllers. And what usually happens is the FPGA starts, the TPM does the fundamental execution, and then it passes control to the BMC, which then forces the server to then boot. So if you could compromise the BMC, you would actually own the entire hardware. Now, historically, the BMCs have not been very secure. That is, vendors who are not very good at making silicon, aka HPE, Dell, Cisco, they are sales organizations, not manufacturers and designers per se. They just outsource all those functions, have done a pretty poor job of making those things secure. We've seen any number of vulnerabilities over the last 10 years where, you know, if you just connect to it on a on an over HTTP and passwords flow in the clear, or quite often you just didn't bother putting in authentication and you'd still be able to log in. Supermicro particularly has had a problematic relationship with its BMCs. They're widely regarded as very poorly done. And so it's always been known that these management networks have always been very vulnerable. And so for most enterprise and installations that I've worked in, the BMC networks, like access to those BMCs via their Ethernet ports on the back of the servers, have been highly protected. We've taken those operational networks and very much restricted access to them to try and prevent that weakness. In this case, I think the Bloomberg article was trying to say that the BMCs, somebody actually put another chip on there that had programming on it, which is as improbable as anything. Like, it's just, that would be the dumbest way to do this. But anyway, so that you could actually take over those servers. Is that a fair set of summaries?
I would add to that, historically they have been a complete security disaster. And I can say in just our own research lab side, we've got to firewall all those off because they light up our vulnerability scanners like mad. And a lot of times the patches for them or the upgrades are a ways off, or they're using outdated versions of Java, or there's probably a whole argument to be made about what's better in your environment. Having having access to these out of band management controllers on your network, or just ripping them out entirely and suffering through the inconvenience of it, but that might actually raise your overall security profile. Yeah. Separate conversation, but they've historically been.
These BMCs are really important because they give you the ability to control. You can alt control, you can hardware reboot the server from them. You can take over the keyboard and the screen remotely. So, if you can connect to the DRAC, you get to see the screen and the keyboard. And increasingly,
hardware rootkit.
Yeah, it is a hardware rootkit. And then we've also seen Intel actually has its own onboard in the CPU. It's actually implemented its own computer to actually manage the CPU itself. And that's also being exposed. So these out of band mods, I'm trying to remember what the Intel, the one that runs Minix that they were talking about. So I'll put a link in the show notes, but Intel CPUs actually have a little Minix implementation that runs on a separate CPU inside of the Intel chipset. It's called Active Management Technology. And this idea was that it would actually be used at the factory to program the chip. And sometimes you can reprogram. The chips are actually got a lot of functionality, and sometimes that functionality is disabled by burning up various wires inside. And this Active Management Technology was meant to be a way to operate it. But it is actually turning out to just be a backdoor into the CPUs. So this sort of stuff is very common.
We are taking a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Interoptic. Interoptic makes optics for networking equipment. They are a data interconnect company. Now, if you're thinking that you can only buy optics branded by the same people that made your switch or router, the OEM, you actually don't. You have choices, and Interoptic is one of the choices worth considering. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, to save money, obviously, but not by buying some cheap third-party optic that fell off of a truck somewhere. Rather, when you buy Interoptic, you're buying a brand-equivalent optic designed by engineers who understand the requirements of real networking environments. Interoptic is not finding the cheapest optic they can source, sticking their label on it, and then selling it to you. This is a company that spends a lot of time thinking about what the future of optics is going to look like and then delivers those products. Stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to the optics experts who deliver brand-equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the OEM price. And if you're not sure what optics to choose, take advantage of their expertise. There certainly are a lot of speeds and form factor choices, and Interoptic can help you sort out what makes the most sense with an eye to the future of your business. Find out more at interoptic.com and listen to Weekly Show 360 for a lot more information on Interoptic. And if you ring them up, be sure to let them know you heard about them on Packet Pushers. And now back to our show.
But you're saying that these BMCs are not something that trusted execution technology, or hardware security can actually fix, because by the time the BMC takes control, the TPM functionality has finished.
Yeah. Well, certainly if you've owned the BNC and you have access to the board, you're kind of done from the beginning. Mm. But presumably, yeah. I mean, the idea is that the BMC software that would be that would have access to the base operating system at that point, we've already booted the base operating system. BMC software is now loaded, and I can manipulate and work with the base operating system long after it's been booted. and still manipulate it. Now, when I reboot, it goes back to that same known good state, presumably.
If somebody's used the BMC or got a chip on the motherboard that can program the BIOS, I can re-inject the code back into the operating system after boot time.
That's correct. That's the point.
Yeah.
The problem with, obviously with networking equipment, these are typically running devices. How often are they typically rebooted, right?
Mm.
So if I want to compromise these devices, all I need to do is use the BNC as a persistence mechanism.
Yes.
And every time I reboot, just reload itself. That's trivial.
I think the other side about networking equipment in particular is they're often not in protected places. So,
that's also true.
Inside of a cloud facility is very much a public cloud or a private cloud. Those data center walls actually restrict access physically, but your router that's sitting inside of some,
closet
or pop,
this becomes particularly interesting when you start thinking about operational environments, OT, like ITS, ICS SCADA environments. A lot of the networking equipment, it's decentralized into field offices that are maybe protected by a chain link fence. Maybe there's a camera, maybe not. So these things are accessible. And there's certainly lots of questions about whether or not they're even accessible via the network itself.
Yeah.
Which is something we're dealing with even today. So.
Yeah, a lot of these SCADA systems don't have, if they have Ethernet interfaces, they might run IP, but they quite often just use Ethernet. But I've worked with SCADA systems in various critical operational environments, and they're just horrendously vulnerable. Like, these people just assumed that nobody would ever access them, and that security wasn't ever an issue. And quite often they have like really easy to use passwords because the real issue was making them operate, not preventing them from being operated.
That's right.
Carry
through obscurity. Yep.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even that. It was just assumed they didn't even have these ideas about security.
Right.
So if we talk a little bit about, so if I'm a vendor and I say, I've got these trusted execution technologies, I've got TPMs on my servers, how does an ordinary person know whether their server's got this technology, and how do they know if it's activated? Like, how do they know if their supply chain is safe?
Sure. So I'll take a shot at this, but I think, taking one quick step back, because I think it's important to kind of frame the discussion of, hey, which vulnerability are we trying to address, right? There's, unfortunately in today's world, like, the attack surface on pretty much any piece of technology in an enterprise is large and getting larger, unfortunately. And so I think the way at least we've thought about it is, in looking at TXT and TPM usage or whatever, it is something that can mitigate a very specific type of attack, but it by no means is comprehensive. And so that would be like first and foremost. Second, before we started recording this show, I actually reached out to one of our hardware reps, regular sales account rep, to find out, hey, what does your portfolio look like in terms of TXT and TPM availability? And I had done this, 4+ years ago when we were working with HITRUST, and I can say that it's gotten a lot better, right? Mm. So, 4 years ago, if I asked my sales rep, my server sales rep, hey, I'm looking for a server that has TXT, he'd be like, what is that? I do not know these words that you speak, right? And now, if you go, and you can go look at this, but if you go look at, say, for example, Dell's website, there are TXT and TPM options on not all of their servers, but the 440 series, the 540 series, 640 and 740. I confirmed those at least. And you can, you're going in and configuring your memory and your CPU and your RAID config and what NICs you want and all of that. And lo and behold, there's a TPM option and you can use it. And so that's great. So from the perspective of like the industry growing up a bit, we're getting there.
Okay.
The flip side, to answer your question, is, look, if you're you don't have this stuff on without knowing it. that's a short version.
Yeah,
because there's some pain associated with it, right? So no one has this running by accident. If you've gone through the pain of specking your servers and getting all this up, and then operationally knowing how to handle things when you get weird messages back, and that's a whole topic in itself. Yeah, you do this intentionally, and that's where I think it breaks down. So I don't think many people have actually gone down this path.
So it's like most security things, everything that you do makes it harder to actually use the product. It's not just a case of buying a server with TPM on board that's got the latest standard. At that point, yes, you've got the car sitting in the driveway, but you still actually aren't sitting in the driver's seat driving it around.
Although Greg, it does bring up a interesting point around, you know, I think a lot of people industry-wide view security as a pain in the butt, right? And I think it's unfortunately gone that way because a lot of our security processes are filled with friction, right? Like, I've got to stop, I've got to pull out a key, I've got to do something, I got to authenticate for the 15th time, I've got, you know, whatever it is, like, we've all felt it, right? I got to patch my server for the upteenth time, right? But if you think about some of the stuff on the consumer side, I mean, you know, when you send off an iMessage or a WhatsApp, you didn't have to accept a PKI certificate, you didn't have to, like, go look at chain of trust. So, I mean, I look at those as examples of security is okay. I mean, you can actually build some great security functionality in, but it's got to be frictionless. It's got to be behind the scenes.
So I like to spin that a little bit different. It's not that it should be frictionless. It's also got to be cheap. Now, when I say cheap, it has to be cost effective in terms of this is how much it costs me to implement it. So the challenge that I have with TPMs recently is the cost of the TPM modules is phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
They're not $50. They're $500, right?
I think it depends on who, right? At least with Dell, I was looking at, it was like, if I recall correctly, it was in the $60 to $70 range option.
Right, okay.
Which isn't too bad.
Maybe it's come down a little bit since then. And then once you've got that, now I've got the cost of activating the security technology. And then once I've got that, I've now got the cost of operating the security technology. And the challenges with security people is that they usually fix one of these things. Oh, we've made this great antivirus technology that'll solve your problems, and then completely forget that actually distributing antivirus technology to 5,000 laptops inside your organization is not a problem. Now, no, just pretend that's not an issue. Just focus on the one app, you know, on the app. You know, don't pretend that. And so I have this real problem with security people productizing what should be a feature. This is not a product.
Sure.
So TXT should not be a feature, should not be a product. It should not be something that you have to buy as a separate product line. It's just a feature. And it should be built in and it should be used all the time. But everything in security has to be a product. So we always want to start up a new startup. We always want to, security companies always want to run around telling us that, you know, like Chicken Little saying, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And I'm looking around going like, quite honestly, in most of the companies I've worked for, it's much more likely that the CEO is going to be banging hookers and the company's going to collapse when that gets out than it is when the company gets breached, which is going to kill the company first.
Yeah. Fair point.
So,
and there's no doubt that there's a fair amount of FUD out there.
Yeah.
You know, and there's we would certainly agree things like TPM and TXT and SGX, and we'll get to at some point, should all be features as baked in. Those aren't separate products. And some of the startups we've seen in that area have been trying to reduce the barrier to entry. And we recognize that as practitioners, that friction is at direct odds with business operations. And we need to ensure that any sort of technology that we're going to be pushing into the to a mission center, business operation, whatever it happens to be, is not fraught with those kind of fundamental like O&M type of challenges.
That's right. So my problem has always been, you put a firewall in. Well, the firewall's fine until you've got 20 of them. And you can't run 20 firewalls predictably or reliably, and they don't fail over properly, and then security becomes a massive cost. A cost in terms of emotional cost, in terms of management time, in terms of planning cost, in terms of... So when I say cost, I mean everything. Money's just one cost, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, and security professionals don't seem to have this joined-up thinking. They're so busy looking up their own fundamentals that they can't actually see the bigger picture is that security actually doesn't matter. You've got a much bigger problem right now at companies like Equifax, where the management team has got zero incentive to fix its breaching problem because it doesn't care, because it's making money hand over fist anyway. So why bother patching the, you know?
And I would challenge some of that. I would just basically say that maybe the priorities are out of alignment with the mission or business priorities, right?
Yeah.
Doing security for the sake of security certainly does not get us where we need to be, but you know, there needs to be a risk-reward calculus as we make investment decisions.
Intel developed this TXT, you know, and the SGX and the hardware, but nobody implemented it. Well, that's a failure of security practitioners because what's the point?
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, you raised some really interesting topics, and I think we could go down a few of those paths. But one thing I would like to point out is that, you know, prepping for this conversation, I mean, obviously the audience is mostly network centric, and sure, you know, everyone intersects with x86 servers, but everything we've talked about up until now has been related to standard x86 servers, right? So when in preparing for the show, I kind of had to ask myself, I'm like, well, look, I know, for example, that Cisco has done a lot of work in trusted boot, code signing. And I think most of the motivation there was along the lines of counterfeit prevention, right? But they still did it, right?
Yeah.
And as someone who has been around the networking world for longer than I'd like to admit, decades, I honestly couldn't answer is what's going on under the hood of a Juniper device, what's going under the hood of an Arista device, is it to the same level of what's going on under the hood of a Cisco device, right? And so on one side, you're absolutely right. When security folks come roll in, create more problems, don't understand total cost of ownership, don't understand friction and impact, and don't understand that some of these things might actually introduce more operational risk than they mitigate, that's a huge community / industry-wide problem. Yeah. But I also think it's interesting that Cisco has made, you know, pretty big strides in this area.
Yeah.
And most of us are unaware of it. Because it was freaking, right?
Well, I suspect part of that is because customers, you know, like a lot of networking professionals have never thought about supply chain integrity. I think a few things drove Cisco down this path. They are very big about having full control of the supply chain. They do not want resellers doing their own thing. They want to absolutely dictate what the market can buy, at what price point they can buy it, and who's going to sell it. So Cisco does not let resellers act independently. They very strongly control them. So there's two things that happened there. One is gray marketing. You know, people were buying Cisco product offshore and then shipping it into, you know, Britain, Europe, America, and able to sell it at a high markup because the product was sold in Asia, where, you know, there are parts of Asia where Cisco is very weak. So they were selling their products heavily discounted to try and make market share. So people were buying pallet loads of Cisco routers and then shipping them to the US. So part of what Cisco did there was actually just to solve its own problem of profitability. I don't want to protect its profits. It didn't want people discounting its products. The second one was, of course, back in the Snowden days when it showed up that the NSA was, you know, unpacking Cisco routers and putting in a hardware implant and then shipping it on. You know, they needed to address that. So they have addressed it so that they can say to customers that can't happen again. Now, neither of those are customer focused. They are Cisco focused. Right, they're about protecting their brand. I don't know if you remember, but back in the 1970s, there was a thing called the Chicago Tylenol murders, and Tylenol someone was going around to the shops, opening up Tylenol and putting poison pills inside of it, and I think 8 people died. And so the solution to that was to put a cap on top of the pills. Now, who were they protecting? Were they protecting the customers, or was Tylenol protecting their brand? And it's a little bit of both, of course, right?
Both, yeah.
But Cisco's motivation behind putting in secure boot technologies was very much about for Cisco. And like anything, it didn't take that to customers and say, we're now saving you from the hardware supply chain, because nobody had a hardware supply chain problem 5 to 10 years ago. And now we do.
Sure. Mm-hmm. It's a fair point. It's an interesting point. And, you know, there's a philosophical side of there of, you know, let's use your Tylenol example, which is a really good one. It did help both. Right. Yeah. And so there's the motivation and then there's the output. And I don't want to get into a whole Machiavellian thing. Like, we'll save that another time. Right. But we have a sample case where, you know, someone, regardless of motivation, you know, Cisco introduced a bunch of technologies in their own product line. Maybe it's to, you know, save their own profit margins, but it raised the bar in their product portfolio as opposed to, you know, what is going on in all of these other products that we use every day.
I think your point, though, is does Cisco, now that the hardware is on everything, do their operating systems actually use that functionality? And I think the answer is yes, because their software licensing must be keyed to they can enforce software licensing using these TPMs.
So that's an interesting point. in regards to Cisco and why they may have solved this or not solved this. But the reality is that through maybe it was their own self-interest, they definitely raised the bar in their own platforms. So, but if we look at how we started this whole conversation in relation to x86 servers and your point of contact that said, hey, we think we've solved a lot of the supply chain problems using this TXT stuff, where they actually didn't solve the problem and they're using this security as a marketing leverage to say that they did, right?
They published a couple of people pointed me to white papers on their website saying we've solved this problem. And what we're now learning is that, they published a couple of white papers, but that doesn't mean it's actually available to it's not there.
It seems almost to be more of a counter to Huawei than anything else, honestly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the other thing about hardware supply chains. I'm interested in your take. We've seen a lot of discussion around over in Australia, they've prevented Huawei from actually tendering for the national telecommunications network build-out process. And it turns out that there was a recent announcement. The problem there was not because the hardware was compromised, but because the employees were compromised. And they actually believed to have proof that the employees were actually giving the passwords and access to the mm-hmm. network to the Chinese government. Now, that's not a hardware supply chain problem. One of the things here mm-hmm. is hardware supply chain breaches is incredibly complex and an incredibly unreliable and expensive way of compromising a device. It's much easier to get an employee in place, right? Get a, you know, mm-hmm. either to turn an employee that's already employed there or get your own secret agent type, you know, spooks type thing and get them on board for 5 years, you know, get them hired and spend a couple of years getting them in positions of trust and they can just do it for you. It's not.
So you make an interesting point about the distinction between a hardware supply chain and just a supply chain challenge, right? And I think one of the things is, I mean, as long as I've been around information security, the supply chain topic, it seems to ebb and flow, right? And people are super interested in it and it's a really hard problem and then they throw up their hands and they go away until the next headline and then we look at it again and then we're super interested. And but if you kind of, at least the way I've thought about it, is if you kind of take a huge step back and you look at the big supply chain problem as it pertains to IT, there's a ton of subcomponents to this, right? So you've got the component manufacturers, the guys that are making the actual chips and the boards and the drag cards and all of that stuff. And then you've got the physical assembly of these things, which sometimes is the same manufacturer, but sometimes not. Like sometimes you have someone building all these components and then you have vendor two putting them all together, right? And then you have the whole software development cycle, right? And there's a whole supply chain there because if most people think that when they get a piece of software from Microsoft or Oracle, that's only being written by Microsoft or Oracle employees, you're mistaken, right? There's contracts and subcontractors, and those people are developing stuff literally all over the world. So you have this huge software development creation component. And then the last piece of it that's, you know, particularly relevant in the networking world is anytime you get an x86 appliance, security appliance that's from fundamentally a software company, there's a good chance there's a third party there that's taking, you know, physical appliance from supply chain A, bringing it in-house, taking software from vendor B, installing it, and then shipping it or drop shipping it, right? Mm-hmm. So and most people don't even think about that last stage, which is the whole other company and ecosystem. And all of that I just said, we still haven't touched on the compromised employee perspective, right? Yeah. So the supply chain problem is really big. And so what I've historically tried to do, at least within our own efforts, is break these things down into smaller pieces and say, okay, you know, where may a TXT or TPM or SGX play, you know, and where do I do other things? And then the last part is, you know, maybe where do I just accept the risk?
Greg, I would add to that just because I didn't hear you say it, but there's an increasing trend towards open source. So we think about supply chain, software development perspective. We are now introducing third-party libraries from Lord knows where. And who knows who has contributed to those libraries. And frankly, it's fairly trivial to understand and appreciate the dependency trees between any particular known like larger project, say Apache Commons, for example, that might be leveraged as part of even some, you know, web service on a one of these BMC controllers. The components that go into that are in the hundreds. And those components and dependencies depend on further dependencies, 3, 4, 5, 6 layers deep, you know, could be developed by, you know, Lord knows who that could have nefarious means. And knowing that Apache Commons is common and prolific in certain applications, you could certainly go after those six tier dependencies with the intention of doing wide, broad scale insider kind of supply chain compromise.
I think my point would be is that as soon as you put an Oracle product or a Windows product on your server, you're not worried about the supply chain, right? Because you've got no way of those companies are notorious for producing highly insecure and unsafe products. You're lucky if they even run most of the time. So worrying about the supply chain is completely worrying about the wrong thing, in my point of view. Like, you know, Windows continues to patch zero, continues to publish. You know, Microsoft, in their glorious wisdom, continues to publish 0 days to this day, right? After 30 years of product development and so-called expertise and leading market company, they still can't produce an operating system which is in any way regarded as safe. And we consistently see privilege escalations of the most fundamental and basic kind. I mean, Oracle products are patching up to 400 bugs in a single release across their product portfolio every month.
I mean, we have to accept that humans are flawed and that we're going to continue to produce.
Have to accept is some companies are not secure. So the supply chain problem is trivial compared to the reality, I think.
And what I think with the point you're making is an extension of the same problem. It's just another form of the same supply chain problem. It's just the risk calculation may be different depending on whether you have, you know, an Oracle or a Microsoft throat to choke versus, you know, an open source ecosystem that you have no one to cry foul to.
try pushing
upstream patches into some six party dependency. It's never.
Well, I would argue that having no one to cry foul to is actually a feature, because then you're actually accepting responsibility for your actions and you have to fix it. Right? Yeah, it's like people who weigh 300 pounds and they go, "It's not my fault. It's McDonald's fault." And you go, "Like
the problem though," and I totally agree with you. But the problem is that, and oftentimes the case is, you'll get, you know, commercially branded software that has third-party open source components that you don't know about.
Yes.
Let's be honest here, though, that, you know, so I think it is important to consider, though, that in any enterprise software, well, most, I shouldn't say any, most enterprise software that we buy today, there's going to be third-party. Some of those might be commercial, some of those might be open source. I think it's dangerous to assume that because it's commercial or because it's open source, it may or may not be better or worse, right? I have closed source products that are god awful and one. I've seen plenty of open source products that have been fantastic and some that have been really terrible.
Yeah.
We're pausing our episode for a moment to discuss a few open source projects. For example, ONI, the Open Network Install Environment, used as the de facto standard in the white box switching world to install a NAS on a new switch or replace a NAS with a different one. Free Range Routing, a fork of the Quagga project providing BGP, ISIS, LDP, OSPF, PIM, and RIP for Linux and Unix boxes, including switches that run Linux, growing in popularity and a Linux Foundation collaborative project. VRF for Linux, a networking project to bring solid VRF functionality into the Linux kernel, including an API and VRF awareness for Linux networking tools. What do these open source projects have in common? Cumulus Networks. Engineers at Cumulus worked on these projects, contributing their efforts to the open source community. For example, we talked to Cumulus's Donald Sharp, one of the keyboard powers behind FR Routing, back on Weekly Show 401. Cumulus gets their business done leveraging open source. As they put it, open source is in their DNA. That DNA has resulted in Cumulus Linux, an open network operating system you can run on a variety of different switches, and NetQ, which tells you exactly what's going on in your Linux-based data center from the container or VM all the way down to the switch port. To find out more about the close ties Cumulus Networks has to open source, visit cumulusnetworks.com/openpod. cumulusnetworks.com/openpod. And now back to the show.
We are talking about hardware supply chains here. I think my takeaway from spending like well over 30 hours reading up on trusted execution platforms and TPMs and all the things that are in there. And I mean, I remember reading a press release from VMware recently saying that they now support the TPM 2.0 standard. Because although they supported TPM.1, TPM.1.0 standard,
1.2.
The 1.2 only had a 19.2K serial bus to talk to the TPM processor. And if you were running more than, what, 5 VMs, you couldn't draw on the TPM or something. Again, you know, the security, the dysfunctional part of the security is, my point would be is that although we can talk about hardware supply chains and they're incredibly frightening, the reality, and it's a bit like talking about the food supply chain, you know, how do you know if the food supply chain's been compromised? And the answer is when you're dead or when you're sick. And it's just so inherently complicated to, you really just have to believe that the system is working the way it is, because fixing hardware supply chains is not a problem that can be reasonably solved today, no matter how hard you try, except for a company like Cisco, which is fully integrated and closed.
Yeah. I think it really boils down to the risk of stating the obvious, risk acceptance, right? And where you want to put your effort, right? Because the reality is, like, yes, it's possible that, you know, one of your suppliers is, and something shows up on your doorstep that that is not what you want to put in your environment. But then there's a higher probability that you've got an outdated drag card somewhere running a horrible version of Java that is just completely pants down, right? Mm. Like, which is the higher probability scenario. It's not to say that they both can't happen, but you probably want to focus on one more than the other.
Yeah, I would be much more concerned about the person sitting next to you, even than, you know, patching the drag, because it's much more likely the person sitting next to you is a, you know, if I'm in a high security environment, I'm looking at the person next to me and thinking, what's his background? What's his family? Has he been vetted? Has he ever had a criminal record? Do we know? I want to come back to one thing here about, and come back to where we started with TXT. If I'm somebody who says, right, I do need to do something about hardware supply chains, I need to start thinking about acquiring servers and routers and switches that have these hardware security features in them. Give me some tips on the things that I need to know about buying these.
Sure. So, I mean, first, this is kind of a no duh answer, but you know, you got to talk to your vendors, and if your suppliers, if the first question you ship with TPMs and TXTs, do I have those options? And they come back to you and they have, I have no idea what you're talking about. That's not a good sign, right? So step one is like looking, I think, at your existing suppliers and ecosystems and see, are they even capable of having this conversation? And if they're not, then you might have some hard decisions to make. The second, and this is common sense, buy some, bring them in, get them up, see how painful it is, and see what the process is to get them configured and make sure you've got staff that are involved in that, right? Mm-hmm. So I think one of the mistakes, I think we've all felt this, one of the mistakes is you get some IT team or Skunkworks team that does something, says, hey, I think this is ready, kicks it over the fence, and then the ops team catches it, and they haven't thought through half of the use cases, right? Or they haven't thought through things like, for example, I patch my kernel, you know, over monthly, quarterly, whatever your patch and release cycle is, and suddenly the boot process has been varied, right? And I'm looking at errors, or it's failing to boot. How do I deal with that, right? And is there an additional step I've got to do in relation to gold imaging? So I think if they're even capable of having the conversation, doing tests, bring stuff in, do a proof of concept.
What about you as a customer? What sort of skills do I need to have to make sense of this? Because one of my areas is that quite often, especially in enterprise IT, we just don't have enough training to even know what a TPM is. And
sure. And let me put a caveat on that before I answer your question, though. I think, you know, most of what we've been talking about is in the x86 realm, right? Mm. This is x86 server realm. There's the obvious question later, but, you know, what do we do with our router and switching and firewall and our other gear, right? Because that's the whole different ecosystem. I mean, not that different, but still different. I think it really boils down to kind of what you did, which was, you know, roll up the sleeves, do some reading, and then start asking questions, right? And if it doesn't make sense to you, something's probably wrong, right? Or the technology is too complex, or it's not ready.
Or the vendor can't explain it, or the person you're talking to can't. Mark, I don't want to blame the vendor. Quite often what I find is the person you're talking to from the vendor can't explain it because they don't know, but they're going to pretend that they know. And you have to keep asking and keep pushing, or, you know, get out there and talk to other people about it, I think.
Right, that's right. One thing that I would add that, Greg, I didn't hear you bring up is, you know, the whole, I mean, what's the point of TPM and TXT if no one's watching it? So one of the things that I've been looking for are vendors who have reduced the kind of the barrier for the management of the TPM and TXT from even a notification perspective. So we talk about, I would ask questions about remote ability to do remote attestation. If I've got 3,000 servers or 3,000 network devices that I'm managing, I'm not going to be able to deal with looking at each one of those independently. I want some sort of centralized management system that tells me that one or two of my devices have come up in an unknown or untrusted state. We should go look at those. And there is a standard around implementing that.
Mm-hmm.
Intel provided kind of the base spec for it, and each vendor is going to implement that completely differently.
Yeah.
If they've implemented that, integrated that into a centralized management console, that's an important tell, I think, how mature their TXT.
See, now, to me, that's another failing of the IT security industry generally, is they've made this technology, which is fine in and of itself, but then they haven't joined it up with everything else. So in practice, antivirus engines should be talking to the TXT and the SGX environment to say, is this server safe to run on? Has my software been tampered with? Have somebody corrupted my DLLs? You know, antivirus technologies don't even run sandboxes. So, you know, Microsoft announced fanfare this week that they're sandboxing the antivirus. And you're going like, what? Is that not? I remember reading that going like, what? That hasn't happened.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly like the right tech for the right problem, part of this for sure. I mean, some things make sense to integrate, some things don't necessarily make sense. You also have to ask like what's in the vendor's best interest and what have you. And something like a TPM, which we all I think agree here is, and TXT broadly, is a feature. And depending on what vendor I'm buying software from or hardware from, I expect that to just be a feature as part of a larger feature set that they're offering to me. Now, whether or not they integrate the reporting perspective into, say, like a SIM architecture or something like that, that's a separate conversation. And I would argue that any vendor today who's not producing logs in syslog format that would enable me to just create my own connectors to centralize that notification is a vendor that's suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Justin, I'd actually like to highlight two things there. One, you're right. I failed to mention what does the process backend look like? But regardless of whether the alert goes to your NOC or your SOC or your help desk or whatever, like what does the downstream process look like if something does go sideways in this TPM ecosystem that you're thinking about enabling? Exactly. That's a great point.
Yeah, and I don't make any sort of assertion of where that data should go. It needs to go somewhere, and someone should look at it.
Yeah.
Too often I see in cyber.
Yeah, and that comes down to building a SecOps or SecOps is an unsolved problem in security. Most security professionals are too busy rushing out startups that do some sort of new firewall, pretending it's a product when it's just a feature. Again, coming back, I find it very difficult as somebody who comments and analyzes the industry to take security professionals seriously until security professionals as customers start saying, we have to have software-defined security. That is, it has to be an entire ecosystem. I have to have one console and I click it and things happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's a whole separate podcast probably around just that topic.
Yeah, it would be an interesting... Yeah. In fact, that could be a whole podcast channel all of its own. But again, we've got this great technology, TXT and TPMs, which can actually secure the hardware supply chain and go take away a lot of the risk of this. You know, somebody's put a chip on the motherboard and, if Bloomberg wasn't, so comprehensively lying about what they were told, it's improbable that would even work, I think, what Bloomberg claimed.
I want to make sure that we're crystal clear on this. So when we think about supply chain in the context of TXT, what we're talking about here is integrity of the boot system and the software associated with that, right? So execution of firmware all the way up through all of the whether it be microcode on the CPU all the way up through, you know, the master boot record or UEFI in the actual like operating system itself. What we're not talking about is measuring the integrity of, say, an option ROM per se on some component inside your graphics card, for example, or some other...
Or the Ethernet NIC. Like I see, I've got a press release in my inbox saying somebody's found a PrivESC inside of the E1000 driver in VirtualBox.
And we're certainly not addressing misconfigurations or misrepresentations by vendors, like the recent BitLocker situation where we've identified that certain drive manufacturers aren't actually doing hardware enforced encryption, or the keys are just readily accessible, right? So, you know, TXT should be thought about as, how do I protect firmware and the software that begins from the power on button through post through all the BIOS initialization all the way up through the operating system.
And then once the boot, but once you access the boot sector on the hard drive, all the TPM, the TXT drops out. It's not part of the chain.
Yeah. 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 It's getting things booted to a point, and then guess what? All bets are off.
And one of the things, one thing I would add to that, that I think is interesting, is when we think about, you know, cloud computing environments, you know, TXT from a hardware perspective is going to assert that the hypervisor, say we have a type one hypervisor, There's not a base operating system like Linux or Windows, but it's actually like ESXi from VMware. When that fully boots, like, I can attest that the hypervisor hasn't been tampered with. When I launch my guests, like there's no continuation of that root of trust.
Yes.
And one of the things that we've looked at, have been tracking, is this. And I honestly don't know what this exact state of this. We stopped watching it a couple of years ago. Is this idea around VPTPM? Virtualized TPMs that can be implemented inside of the hypervisor provides that continuation root of trust up into the guest. So as the guest itself boots, you know, how do we also assert that as well?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's, I think, central to what like HITRUST was trying to do with some of their product offerings.
That's right. And it's also the sorts of things where if I put a VM into someone else's infrastructure, you know, whether it's on-prem or off-prem or co-load or in a public cloud facility, how do I know that the hardware I'm running on, there is a theory that you could say somebody could potentially compromise the hardware in a public cloud, and I would never know.
And not just the hardware, but the hypervisor, the software itself.
Yes, that's hardware. Right. So the thing is about this, and so to come back to the whole story, you know, we are talking here about the hardware protections. My bottom line takeaway from this is, if you're worrying about the hardware supply chain, is mostly pointless, because you've got bigger problems somewhere else in your infrastructure, like you're not patching regularly, or antivirus software is not well done, or the suppliers that supply you with software are doing a pretty poor job, and you've got much bigger problems with your Oracle software than you have with your hardware supply chain.
Well, I would add to that, though, Greg, in that I think if you look at what your operational practices are and what your risk management strategy is, you know, that's very pragmatic, and you're not going to fix hardware. You know, you as one entity, company, whatever, are not going to fix the hardware supply chain problem. But I do think it's worth raising the point that I've heard you make on other podcasts, which is consumers have a fair bit of power, right? And if we don't ask for something, it's pretty guaranteed we're not going to get it, right? And so I think, you know, operationally, day to day, like, yeah, we probably need to be, you know, focused on the basics, which we clearly don't still do, right? Like, yeah. How many compromises are related to someone didn't patch or someone used admin, right? Yeah. So we got to get rid of those. That's our responsibility on kind of the ops side. But on the vendor supplier side, I don't think it's unfair to start asking some of our suppliers, hey, how are you handling software distribution, right? Yes. Have you considered putting a TPM in a switch, right? Have you considered, you know, hey, we're looking at this stuff on the x86 server side, but, you know, Mr. Vendor, I'm not patching my switches and my routers at the same frequency that I'm patching my servers. I'm not rebooting my switches and routers at the same frequency. Like, I need you to really have a tight chip. And what are you doing for me? Right. And so I think as consumers, it's in our best interest to get smart of this and start thinking about what questions we should be asking Arista and Juniper. And then we haven't touched on this yet, but the whole disaggregated white box arena, right? whole other can of worms, right?
Yes.
Because Cisco's been able to pull off what it's been able to pull off because they control the ecosystem, you know, front to back, similar to how Apple does it. And when you enter the realm of white box switches and SDN, like that's a whole new ballgame.
Yeah, and the challenge here is that Cisco has been able to do that at substantial cost, and it's been able to charge customers for that cost, as has Apple. And at the same time, white box switches are now a fraction of the cost of Cisco, and customers, Cisco either has to get out there and explain the value of this security tooling that it's put together, and how they're what value that can bring to the customer, and or the market will decide to go with the cheapest product.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair, because you're not having an apples to apples conversation at that
no,
point.
No, no. But the flip side here is, and my point would be, is the actual chance of a hardware supply chain compromise is very, very low. Effectively, it's the hardest possible way to breach your network. The second thing is that as long as you've got even if you had the way this article was written, even if you had a hardware implant, you still have to turn that into something useful. So you have to exfiltrate data, and you can't have a hardware implant that is inactive most of the time unless you've got a way to activate it. And then when it captures the data, you have to get it somewhere. So if you're running a 10 gig switch that's got 48 10 gig ports, you're not going to be able to, you've got to program it to capture a very specific set of data. So I'm not sure that the risk profile around a switch or even an internet scale router is actually practical, because what are you going to do? Capture data, manipulate the BGP table? Are you going to do a DDoS attack? I mean, quite honestly, if you're going to make a switch so that it just dies every now and then, that's pretty difficult to tell the difference between a real switch and our switch that's been fuddled with. Because, you know, we have enough hardware reliability issues with switches these days to be worried about whether they're actually going to stay up for very long.
So I think one thing that we should keep in mind is we've seen plenty of demonstrations over the last couple of decades about what you could do with a Linux node that's on the public internet, right? And whether it's a baby monitor or a web server or a router or a switch, for better or worse, Linux is becoming a bigger and bigger foundation of a lot of network routing and switch systems, right? And so I wouldn't want to discount the importance of making sure that, you know, your switch isn't owned, right? In particular, because, you know, Cisco has such a dominant position and so many networking professionals are super comfortable with an iOS interface, but not as comfortable running at a bash prompt and do a lot of stuff in Linux. So I think...
Yeah, I tell you one thing, it just struck me. I do know one area where TPMs have become a big deal is actually in SD-WAN. So a lot of these SD-WAN boxes actually boot from the cloud, and most of the SD-WAN providers are actually using TPM and TXT to actually do the boot cycle. So,
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the areas we saw as kind of a ripe for opportunity from our perspective as an investor was around SD-WAN. And these devices are traditionally virtualized, or there's some higher order software that's running on these devices, like Java. And providing some mechanism to allow these systems to be zero-touch provisioned means that I'm hosting them and putting them out someplace where I don't necessarily trust the infrastructure or environment they're sitting in, whether it be a branch office or some remote data center. I need to still find some way to remotely attest its running state.
Yes.
They are looking at TPM and TXT to effectively provide that. Again, I still make the same point, is that once it's booted, you know, all bets are off again.
Yes, but that's how they address the... I really should have mentioned this much earlier in the show, but that is how they address the... How do they validate that the code that they've downloaded or that's booting on the device is actually valid? They actually go quite a long way into the TPM, TXT features to get that to work. And
that's
great.
You bet.
Yep.
You bet.
Yeah. But they are also... effectively, that's an implementation of a security system that's been done from the ground up. And in the case of SD-WAN, there's significant savings there, because now I no longer have to ship the device to a reseller who takes it out of the box, updates the firmware, and then carries the box out to site to plug it in. In the case of SD-WAN, you just ship it directly from the factory to the branch. Nobody touches it in the middle. So you have to have these new features, and this is where the TPM root of trust does actually come good.
That's right. And several years ago, I know before Cisco bought Viptela, That was something they were contemplating. It wasn't actually part of the product offering yet.
Yes, I'm not. I don't want to make assertions about who's doing it, which is why I didn't mention a brand. But I know that some of them are doing it, and that's how they get over. They establish the trust for it.
But that's, Greg, that's a fantastic point, because, you know, you might, we might be looking at the future there, right? I mean, if for folks that have been around for several decades, like, there was a point in time where Windows Update wasn't a thing,
yeah,
right? Like, new Vulns came out and you had to, like, do the same thing you had to do with iOS, right? You go to the vendor, download the patch, install the package, whatever. And, you know, now, if, you know, at least with our average servers and desktops, like, we can we can put that thing on autopilot. We can save ourselves, right? And I recognize that operationally, that's terrifying for standard, you know, network operations, because things can go sideways and availability rules. But you know, maybe that is a window into the future, in that we're able to automatically update things, and a byproduct of that is we're able to get firmware more securely.
I think the advantage here is that these solutions have access to an SDN controller, and that centralized points of control makes the use of TPM practical. And a lot of these software-defined networking features are fairly rigidly structured so that the devices matter less than the actual software-defined operation does. And so now we can actually take advantage of these features because they can all be centrally programmed from an SDN controller type environment. So, you know, ACI, NSX, you know, that type of thing. There's a transition here that actually activates these technologies. And this comes back to the point I perhaps made too much during the show, which was, you know, during our discussion, which was that most security professionals fail to consider the operationalization and the usability of these technologies. They rush out running around like Chicken Little saying the sky is falling, we have to have the new thing, and then fail to consider that don't have the resources to use this in 6 months' time. So, well, hopefully that wraps up the discussion. Are there any closing thoughts you guys wanted to add before we wrap up?
I would just kind of highlight what you said about the whole SDN controller side. I hadn't actually thought about that. That's a really good point. I mean, we run Big Switch internally, and, you know, our switches phone home, grab their new firmware build, and we don't have to do anything, which is awesome experience, right? So I think that's really important. I do think there's a role for us as consumers to start putting a little heat on our network suppliers and say, hey, how does this work? And then on the vendor side, I think it's about making good security decisions, but to your point, making them frictionless, right? So bake it in there, but don't make my life
horrible.
Make my life horrible as an operator.
Yep. And Justin, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think Greg summarized it perfectly. And at some point here, we have to make sure we get you introduced to some security practitioners who can appreciate what it feels like to actually run operations.
Yeah. That'll be interesting. Like, people who can actually, like, understand that sort of stuff. Well, on that note, thanks very much for listening to Packet Pusher's weekly podcast. It's been great to have you here. Thank you so much for listening. Now, you can follow these guys on the internet. There's a couple of different places. Head on over to the show notes at packetpushers.net to catch them. You can find this and many more free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on the Twitter, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. It would be a great help to us if you could actually leave a review, because it is a great way for us to find new audience and to continue to sustain the show going forward. And as always, remember, last but not least, too much technology would never be enough.